Okay, folks, we're going to continue by looking at the various types of bonds. Real exciting stuff, don't you think? Slide 25. And again, as we said before, the book goes into far more detail about bonds than we are going to in our presentation and our study. Treasury bonds, government bonds, T-bonds, and T-notes. Remember, the T-treasury note is 2, 5, 10 years. I still call them treasury bonds. Don't confuse these, though, with treasury bills. It's okay to confuse treasury bonds and treasury notes. They're basically the same thing, but treasury bills are different. Those are the short-term debt obligations we talked about in Chapter 1, 30 days, 90 days, 180 days. Treasury bonds are greater than 10 years, treasury notes 2 to 10 years. And then there are TIPS, becoming more and more popular, Treasury Inflation Indexed Obligations. The principal is adjusted each year by the inflation rate. So people who buy bonds often are very worried about inflation, so the government created these TIPS, and we'll see how popular they are as inflation. If inflation goes up, they should become even more popular. But people bought these things like crazy a few years ago because they were afraid of inflation, and so far inflation hasn't been a problem. It may be if the Federal Reserve is not able to withdraw all the money they've injected into the system. But so far, it has not been a problem. And then agency bonds. They're not direct obligations of the United States Treasury, so they technically don't have the same weight, so to speak, the same gravitas as Treasuries, but they're considered very safe with almost no risk of default. Why? Because history bore it out. For many years, the United States government said, we are not going to bail out Fannie or Freddie. No, they are private institutions, even though the Congress sponsored these two companies and other entities like them to help the home loan mortgage market. But when things went very, very bad in 2008, what happened? Right. The United States government came in and basically bailed out Fannie and Freddie, and you are now part owner of these two large mortgage funding institutions. And because of the Constitution, whereas the feds can't tax the states can't tax the feds, Treasury interest is exempt from state income taxes. So you don't pay California, those of you Californians, you don't pay income tax on the interest from the state that you receive from the United States Treasury. You still pay federal income tax. Slide number 26, TIPS. Okay, let's take a more in-depth look at TIPS. How do they work? Well, they're a type of Treasury security that provides protection against inflation by adjusting the investor's return for the annual rate of inflation. Okay, so you're a bondholder, you're very worried about inflation. So what can you do? Well, if you buy a regular bond, not much, right? If inflation raises its ugly head, the value of your bond is going to be seriously impaired. Well, a TIP works this way. A Treasury Inflation Indexed Obligation. You initially are paid less than other Treasury bonds, but every year the par value, remember the $1,000 face value, is adjusted upward each year to keep pace with inflation. So, for example, if the inflation is 2%, not only do you get your interest, but your bond would go from 1,000 to 1,020, right? Because that's 2% of inflation plus whatever interest you get. Therefore, the interest payment goes up next year because the par value increased. Yeah. That's pretty cool, isn't it? However, you must pay taxes on the interest and the increase in the par value, even though you did not receive the increase in par value as cash. The IRS says, wait a minute, you know, you received a $20 capital gain, so to speak. I don't think it's treated like a capital gain. I think it's treated as interest. But still, you understand? If inflation does get bad, your bond is going to increase in value, and your interest payment's going to go up. Now, what's the problem with these things? Well, as we just said, you have to pay taxes on money you didn't really receive. It's a phantom increase. Not really. I mean, we could turn around and sell it for $20 more, all other things being equal, but they never are. But the real problem with these things is they pay almost nothing. They're so popular with some paranoid individuals, investors out there, that they've bid up the price and they pay very, very little. So, not in my humble opinion, not the best deal. But if inflation ever did come back with a vengeance, as it did in the late 70s, early 80s, these things are going to be really, really popular. And the people who bought them are going to look really smart. Slide number 27. Mortgage-backed bonds. Mortgage-backed securities. Oh, they have all kinds of names, folks. CMOs, collateralized mortgage obligations, CDOs, collateralized debt obligations, pass-through securities, participation certificates. These are debt issues secured by a pool of home mortgages, issued primarily by government-sponsored entities such as Fannie and Freddie, right? So what do they do? The idea was to increase liquidity, which is a fancy way of saying getting more money out there. And they worked really well for a long time, folks. The idea was to make more mortgages available so more people could buy houses because that makes communities stronger. This was the conventional wisdom. The problem is if one is good and two is better, 27 must be best, right? And yeah, in our rush to make everybody a homeowner, housing prices skyrocketed, and we all became, well, not all of us. I want to say me and my friend and I were jumping up and down and screaming and hollering, saying this ain't going to last. We weren't the only ones, but we were taking bets, and he thought the market was going to fall for real estate 50% or more. I said, oh, no, 20%. He was right. So the idea is if you go get a home loan, you go to a credit union or a bank, and you think you're dealing with the bank, right? Well, you are. You're dealing with the bank. But as soon as they make the loan, or maybe soon afterwards, after they make the loan, they turn around and sell it to one of these agencies, one of these, for a while there, publicly traded companies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, right? And then Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac pulls them together, packages them, bundles them into a loan, into a bond offering. So they then sell them all around the world. Now, they weren't the only ones doing this, folks, but they were the big ones. They're accounting for more than 70% of the marketplace. So the investors who buy these pass-through securities, these collateralized debt obligations, receive interest and principal as the homeowners pay off their mortgage. So you're paying the mortgage to your credit union or your bank, and they're just turning around sending it to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who then send it to the people who bought the bonds. It's a process called securitization. And it worked great for a while until exactly we all became... we all became victims of yet another extraordinary popular delusions in the madness of crowds thinking that forever and ever home prices were going to go up and you'd never have to, how did that work out? Not so good. And we're still working our way through it, but there are some brighter signs. We're not done yet. Slide number 28. asset-backed securities. Yes, we just mentioned this term, securitization. Mortgage-backed securities are just one type of securitization. The securitization is a process of transforming lending vehicles such as mortgages into marketable securities. But it doesn't have to be mortgages. It can be done with almost any debt or any asset. The success of mortgage-backed bonds spread into other asset-backed securities. These are similar to the mortgage-backed securities we just discussed, but they are backed by bank loans, unsecured bank loans, maybe credit cards, leases, other assets, patents, stocks and bonds. It got to the point where David Bowie, you know him, David Bowie, the started his career in the 70s as a glam, glitter rock, and then transformed himself a few times. And in the 1980s, he said, look, you know, I am David Bowie. I'm a very famous and successful artist. I'm going to securitize the stream of income that my career is creating. And I think it was a small issue by bond. I think it was $55 million. I remember the name and the number, $55 million, which, you know, in the bond world is not that much. But for an individual to, for an individual to sell bonds based on their career, and then, of course, he had to pay back the bonds with interest. And he did. They all worked out fine. He wasn't the only one that did it. Another band by the name of REM. Did the same thing. Very interesting. So these have names very similar to the collateralized debt obligations, collateralized bond obligations, structured investment vehicles. Some of these in the meltdown went very badly. So the Bowie bonds and the REM bonds, I think, were fine. Well, I know the Bowie bonds were. So you see, this industry as a whole got a real black eye in the 2008-2009 debacle, and they're coming back ever so slowly because this really is a, unlike some other schemes out there in the financial world, this really is an important process and an important tool in our ability to keep the economy humming along and getting capital in the right places. So hopefully in 5-10 years from now, we'll look back and say, boy, I'm glad we were able to put the safeguards in place and the industry was able to get itself righted, and securitization is now an important tool, well regulated, and so we don't have to deal with that issue again. We'll have to deal with some other issue, obviously. Nothing's perfect. Slide 29. Now, let's turn our attention to muni bonds, municipal bonds. Most people just say munis. These are debt securities issued by states, counties, cities, and other political subdivisions. Most of these bonds are tax-exempt. Don't use the term tax-free. The IRS doesn't like that. They are free of federal income tax on interest. So, again, this is part of the deal between the states and the local municipalities and the federal government. Feds can't tax the state and local governments. State and local governments can't tax the feds. But capital gains, no. If we have any capital gains, in other words, we bought it with interest rates high, interest rates have gone down, we sold it for a profit, a capital gain, no, that's not tax exempt. Now, you have to be careful, especially if you are subject to the dreaded alternative minimum tax, because some of the muni bonds have been ruled non-tax exempt if you are subject to the alternative minimum tax. So if you buy a bond, if you're in this rarefied air, you probably have a broker or other financial professional helping you, but you want to make sure that you, if you're looking for tax-exempt interest, tax-free interest, you don't buy any of these AMT-eligible bonds. Muni bonds are very popular with individual investors, especially the high-income and high-net-worth taxpayers. Why? because they're paying a lot of interest, right? And so, a lot of it taxes. I'm sorry, they're paying a lot of taxes, and they want to get tax-free, tax-exempt. And some muni bonds are insured. This is a very desirable feature. The problem was that some of the same companies that were insuring the muni bonds then moved into the corporate bond and the securitized bonds, the mortgage-backed bonds, and had their heads chopped off when the organic matter hit the ventilating device. So they're, a couple of those companies are basically gone. But you can still get insured muni bonds. Slide number 30. There are a few types of muni bonds. GOs, government obligation bonds, and these are muni bonds that are backed by the full faith, credit, and taxing power of the issuer. You could think of them like a credit card for the state of California or the city of Chula Vista. The city of Chula Vista says, hey, we're the city of Chula Vista. We have taxing authority. Will you lend us money? And so investors say, okay. So the GOs have to be paid. the government has to come through and pay these things. And so if they can't, then they have to, you know, raise taxes or whatever. Can an entity such as a city or a state, can it go bankrupt? Well, yes, technically, but it's very, very rare, and it's very hard to do, because if the entity goes before the bankruptcy court, the bankruptcy court's going to say, well, you could tax your people more until, you know, obviously there's no tax base left, then possibly the default will be allowed on the part of the bankruptcy court. A few years back, the city of San Diego, they're still dealing with it, but the crisis seems to have subsided somewhat. In the 1990s, the city government made some really boneheaded decisions about the pension plans, and the blame is often attached to the union. Now, I'm not a big fan of unions, folks, especially the one here at Southwestern, but in this case, it wasn't the union's fault. The city of San Diego, in order to attract the Republican National Convention in 1996, didn't pay all their pension obligations. And the unions, this is their job, jumped up and down and said, what are you talking about? You can't do this. You have to pay, you know, it's in our contract. You have to pay these amounts into the pension plan. And the city leaders, Mayor Golding at the time, and Byron Weir and Valerie Stallings, they said, sit down, relax, Booby, relax. We got a deal for you. And sure enough, they made a sweetheart deal with the union so they wouldn't have to make the pension plan obligations, called the DROP program, which really was a good deal, where you could, if you were a city employee and you were eligible to retire, you could announce your retirement up to 5 years in advance, continue to work for the city, and in the meantime, you're collecting your salary because you're still working. You're not retired. But the money you would have gotten if you had retired was then put into a retirement account, a separate retirement account on your behalf. This was the DROP program. I forget exactly what DROP stood for, but oh, boy, the union just said, no problem, we'll sign here. And that's how the city got itself into this mess. Well, many people were saying, the city should go bankrupt, the city should declare bankruptcy. And they really didn't. Either they didn't understand what they were talking about, or they knew they were just blowing smoke. Because if the city were to go before the bankruptcy judge and say, we're City of San Diego, we're broke, can we get out of these debt obligations? The bankruptcy judge would have laughed. Just would have, unless there was some backroom deal, folks, I don't know, they would have said, this is the city of San Diego, you are one of the largest cities in the country, what are we, 8th or 9th? We used to be 7th, but Phoenix overtook us. You haven't even begun to tax the way you could tax, such as big cities in the East Coast. So it was never an option. revenue bonds. The second group are muni bonds that require payment of principal and interest only if sufficient revenue is generated by the issuer. Now, all other things being equal, and they never are, these are less desirable than general obligation bonds. Why? Because, say, you build a bridge, and you're going to charge tolls, and that's how you're going to pay the bonds off, and nobody uses the bridge, or the freeway, the South Bay Expressway, yeah, right. So, revenue bonds are less desirable than government general obligation bonds. But no, folks, most revenue bonds are created because there is a need for a water authority or the bridge across the Coronado Bay Bridge. Very interesting bridge, the Coronado Bay Bridge. When they built it, the Navy was quite worried about if it ever were to be attacked as a target and bottled up the harbor, bottled up the San Diego Bay. They were worried about that because then all the ships in the Navy Yard below the bridge couldn't get out. So what did they do? They required that the bridge could float. Huh? Yeah, right. The Coronado Bay Bridge can float. If it ever falls down, they can just push it. It's in pieces, and they can just push it out of the way. Wow, what a feat of engineering. And those bonds that were sold to build the bridge were paid off via the tolls that people paid to get across. Notice you paid when you went into Coronado. You didn't pay to get out of Coronado. Very interesting. And then once the bonds were paid off, the toll was supposed to go away. Well, it didn't quite go away just yet. They kept it going, the toll. They lowered it and removed it if you were in a carpool. They lowered it and kept it going enough so that they could build up a maintenance fund. And to be truthful, folks, I think they just kept it going to keep this one guy who started there. He started his career as a toll booth teller, as a toll booth clerk, when the bridge opened, and he stayed until the toll booth closed. The day he retired, they closed the toll booth. So I don't know if that's true, but it's true. I don't know if they used him as their guide, but he started the day it opened and he ended the day it closed. That's very interesting. And then there are the special tax bonds that we've discussed. They are payable by proceeds of a special tax. And those of you who are students of Southwestern College, you've heard of the Proposition AA and the Proposition R bonds. The South Bay voters had to approve the tax. They had to say, yeah, it's okay for you to tax us via the property taxes. We'll pay for the interest and the repayment of the bonds over 30 years or whatever. Okay? Okay. Slide number 31, the municipal bond tax advantages. Okay, what are they? Well, if you're a high net worth individual, they certainly are worthwhile to look at. They are free from federal income taxes, and so what we need to do is we need to compute the taxable equivalent yield, and we'll learn how to do that. If the bonds are purchased by investors in that municipality, they are also often free from state and local taxes. So we have to compute for them the taxable equivalent yield for both federal and state exempt. So most of us here listening to this are California taxpayers. So if you're a California taxpayer and you buy a bond based in California, it doesn't have to be from the state of California. It could be city of Chula Vista, city of San Diego, or a bridge or a water or another type of authority, school district based somewhere in California. You do not pay any federal income taxes because it's a muni bond. Plus, you do not pay any California income tax because the state of California says, hey, you know, this is a way to sweeten the deal for people who live in California to buy bonds based in California. Now, obviously, the higher the tax bracket of the investor, the higher the taxable equivalent yield. That's why these things, by definition, are much more valuable to somebody at the highest and the higher tax brackets. So what they do is they essentially bid up the price to the point where they really, for the most part, don't make that much sense for those of us in the middle to lower middle. Income brackets. However, as we said, capital gains are never exempt from taxes. You have to pay taxes on the capital gains. Now, let's turn our attention to corporate bonds. Slide number 32. Corporate bonds come in two flavors, secured and unsecured. And you can think of this like a mortgage, right? A mortgage where there's, or a car loan, there's something backing, some kind of collateral. And those are the secured bonds. And the unsecured bonds, you could think of as credit cards or other types of unsecured debt where they're just backed by your reputation, the full faith and credit, so to speak. So the secured bonds then come in different flavors. There are senior bonds, like the first trust deed of your mortgage, backed by the claim of a specific property of the issuer. Could be real estate, could be large equipment such as railroads or airplanes or patents. Yeah. And then junior bonds are like a second mortgage, a second trust deed for your house. They are second in priority to the senior bonds. And then there's an entire pecking order in some cases when the issue is very large. The unsecured debentures, I've heard them said both ways, I'm not exactly sure which one's right, they are backed by, and then subordinated, right, so there's a pecking order within the unsecured loans, they are backed by the full faith and credit of the entity. So the corporation is JCPenney's, and we're JCPenney's, you know, we're a retail outlet, and we've been around for over 100 years. Will you lend money to us? Well, what happens if things go bad? You got to go after JCPenney. You don't get a claim to any of their specific properties. And that's exactly what happens in credit cards, right? And then there are some income bonds that are just like the revenue bonds of the munis. They are unsecured bonds requiring that interest is paid only after a certain amount of income is earned, possibly on a special project or the like. So which one, all other things being equal, which ones would you rather have? Right, you'd rather be secured, all other things being equal, and they never are, and then you go down the line. Of course, if it's a secured bond, you think it's going to pay more or less than an unsecured bond? You got it right. And the higher the risk, the higher the return, or investors will just say, well, I'm not going to buy that unsecured bond, I'll buy the secured bond if it pays the exact same amount. Slide number 33, zero coupon bonds. That's a silly name. What does it mean? Well, remember we talked about coupon rate and coupon clipping? So these were bonds that are sold with no coupons attached to them. Well, it's all electronic now, so there are no interest payments. How do you get paid? Well, they are sold at a deep discount from the par value. Aha! Instead of receiving the interest in cash, the bonds simply accrue, that's the word we use, it means grow, in value until maturity. So say you were going to buy a $1,000 bond that matured in 20 years and the bond was paying 6.25%. You would pay approximately $300. And then, as you got closer and closer to the maturity, the bond's value would increase. So after 10 years, it would be worth $550. After 20 years, it would be worth $1,000. Now, this is great for people who don't need the interest as income. They're not buying the bonds for income. They're buying the bonds for the capital appreciation, the growth over time. What are the disadvantages? Well, they're very sensitive to interest rates changes, exhibiting wide price swings. Remember, the interest rates go down, bond prices go up, interest rates go up, bond prices go down. But if you don't plan to sell your bond, what do you care? But here's the real rub, fly in the ointment. The IRS expects you to pay taxes on the accrued interest even though you did not receive that accrued interest in cash. You understand? Some people use the term phantom income. Phantom because you don't really see it. I mean, your bond's worth more, but you have to pay income tax on that. What a deal! Well, the IRS says you received something even if you didn't get it in cash. So for that reason, people often put these in tax-sheltered accounts such as IRAs. Right, you got it. You don't pay income tax on the interest in an IRA. Or they buy zero-coupon muni bonds, which exactly are not taxable by the IRS. So make sure you understand this term, because even though there are no more coupons and bonds, people are going to use the term. A zero-coupon bond is a bond that pays no interest, is bought at a deep discount, and matures at $1,000, most of them $1,000. Slide number 34, junk. Junk bond? Yeah, junk bonds, yeah. We don't use the term junk. We say non-investment grade or high yield bonds. They have low ratings. These corporations are in distress, or maybe municipalities, but they produce high yields for the same reason that people who have bad credit ratings, you know, have to pay higher interest. The same thing is true for these bond issuers. And it used to be that junk bonds were just, you just didn't talk about these in polite company. But in the 1980s, they became an industry, as companies that were not normally or traditionally large enough to issue bonds began to issue bonds with very high interest rates. And there's a whole, this is a whole history lesson, yet another scandal in the industry was perpetrated by some of these junk bonds. In fact, it was based here. Vagabond Inns. You might have seen a Vagabond Inn. There's a few in town. They're based here. And they were, a gentleman by the name of Ivan Boesky was using Vagabond Inns as a front. They were creating issuing these junk bonds based on Vagabond Inns, saying they were going to do all kinds of wonderful things and make Vagabond Inns a nationwide chain. Really, all they were doing with the cash that they were receiving from the sale of the junk bonds was doing insider trading. And he had a gentleman on the inside of the company. The company was named Drexel Burnham Lambert. His name is Michael Milken. He went to jail, so did Ivan Boesky. And he and Ivan were doing insider trading back and forth. And the movie Wall Street was basically based on Mr. Milken and Mr. Boesky. Very high risk, folks. But they often offer the opportunity for large capital gains as well as high income. Why? Because if the company is in distress, the bonds are going to fall precipitously. If the company comes back, then the junk bonds are going to rise in value. And we're going to see that on the website. You're going to see a little presentation about Ford. You're going to see the Ford bonds just tank during the financial crisis of 2008-2009 and then start to regain themselves. So although we normally say that bonds and stocks move in opposite directions, they're not well correlated, junk bonds tend to have a high correlation, and we'll talk about that later in detail, correlation. They tend to follow the stock market as opposed to following the bond market. Slide number 35, foreign bonds. There are two types of foreign bonds. There are U.S. pay bonds, and they're not as popular as they used to be, but what these countries would do is they would say, you know what, we need money. Where's the money? It's in the United States. So we'll borrow the money, dollar denominated, even though we're Argentina or we're Thailand or whatever. I don't know if Thailand did it, but I know Argentina and many of the other Latin American companies did this in the 1980s when they were really hard up, so to speak, for cash. They issued bonds, but the interest and the principal was paid in U.S. dollars. So the investors didn't have to worry about currency fluctuations. They knew they were going to get paid back in dollars. All other bonds are foreign pay bonds, which means, right, you have the currency issue you have to deal with. You're going to trade your dollars for yen or pesos or euros or what's the one in Brazil? Real? No, that's not real. I forget the name. You're going to move it to a different currency. So just as we talked about when we talked about buying foreign stocks, you have the same issue with foreign bonds. If the U.S. dollar rises, all other things being equal, and they never are, the value of the bond will fall. If the U.S. dollar falls, the value of the bond will rise. Very interesting. It's normally, traditionally, has been very difficult for individual investors to purchase, and most people did it via global bond mutual funds, but more and more brokerage firms make it very easy for you to have a global or international, they were used to call it, now I think they're called global, brokerage account, global or international brokerage account, and you could keep dollars plus pesos plus euros plus reals and all other types of currencies in your account and buy and sell items on different exchanges. So that's becoming more and more popular and easier to do and not as costly as it used to be. Slide number 36. What's the basis of the bond industry? Well, it's the same idea as the basis of the credit industry for individuals. How does a bank or credit rating know whether you're a credit union. How does a bank or credit union know that you're somebody they should lend to? You have a credit score that is created by these super bureaus. Well, the same kind of thing happens for bonds. There are these rating agencies. The two big ones are Standard & Poor's, and then there's Moody's, and there's another couple, Fitch's and Weiss and one or two others. But the two big companies are Standard & Poor's and Moody's. And they assign a letter grade to designate investment quality. The higher the rating, the better the quality of the bond. I like to think of them as the warning lights, the idiot lights on your dashboard. Because, I'm not a motorhead, I'm not a big motor car fan, folks, but in the past, once the little red light saying that your oil is in trouble or your engine is hot, once that light went on, it's too late. It was too late. You might as well keep driving. You only got another couple miles before the car just engine seizes up and the car stops. But supposedly now, my apologies to the car companies, the warning lights have gotten better. You know, so if you do, don't listen to me. If you do see the warning light go on, pull over immediately and fill the tank with oil. Fill the, not the tank, fill the engine with oil. Don't put oil in your gas tank. Fill the radiator with water. Because with regard to bonds, these rating agencies were caught completely flat-footed, caught completely off guard in 2001, 2002. They didn't downgrade Enron and WorldCom until they were practically in default. These were companies that had perpetrated massive fraud upon the public. They are again being called to task because of the mortgage-backed bond crisis. Yep, you guessed it. They screwed up again, but this time they almost brought down the entire economy. How did they do this? Well, remember the mortgage-backed securities, the collateralized debt obligations? They were giving these things AAA ratings. Sure, no problem. People are always going to be able to pay off their mortgages. Plus, housing prices will never go down. Remember, we looked at Value Line for McGraw-Hill, the people at the company that owns S&P. Right. Boy, were they. Did they look bad. Well, it's a bit of a conflict of interest. The rating agencies are paid by the companies that are issuing the bonds. So, if you're being paid by the people who you are rating, are you going to give them a bad rating? They will take great umbrage at the assertion that there is a conflict of interest. That means they'll act shocked that you said that. But, yeah. Because they did so badly in 2001, 2002, and then again in 2007, 2009, 2008, 2009, they... did a preemptive strike in 2011. They said, oh, we're not going to get caught again. You see this federal government, the Republicrats and the demagogues can't decide on anything. They can't even raise the debt limit. We're going to downgrade the United States government. And they did. They downgraded from the highest, which the government has always had and deserves, AAA, as we'll see on the next slide, down to AA+. And you would think that if people believed them, people would have, if investors had believed that the rating agencies, the Standard & Poor's, they would have flocked away from government bonds, because that means government bonds had a smaller chance of paying. Well, the opposite was true. They flocked away from stocks because they were afraid the world was going to end. Crazy old world. Slide number 37. Here are the bond ratings. And to me, I don't know. What's the difference between AA and A and AAA and B? It reminds me of eggs. You go to the store and it says, these are AA eggs. These are A eggs. These are B eggs. What's the difference? I don't know. But AAA is the highest rating you can have. And the federal government had AAA forever until 2011, and then, oh well. Anything below BBB is starting the non-investment grade, speculative, aka also known as junk. So BBB, AAA, AAA are all investment grade. Then you get down to B, C, 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 D. By the time the bond is rated CC or C or D, forget it. It's too late. The idiot light came on and the engine is seized. Slide number 38. The rating agencies further fine-tune their ratings. So they'll put a plus or a minus. So it goes AAA and then AA plus and then AA and then AA minus and A plus and A and A minus and then, and Moody's adds a 1, 2, or 3. I think this is silly. I don't know. Obviously, I don't work for these places. So how do they differentiate between a AA plus and an AA? I don't know. In the past, they've shown that they don't really do a very good job of this. So who do you believe? That's a real good question. Who do you trust? Slide number 39, bond trading. Okay, well, are you and I going to trade bonds, folks? Not likely. Bond trading is very difficult for retail investors. Trading volume is often thinned. Why? Because most people just buy their bonds and hold on to them. Most bonds trade over the counter. I mean, you got to go find somebody that has them. The bond traders normally trade in the $100,000 range. Yeah, you're going to go see a couple ads on the website. It's going to say, minimum $25,000. Yeah. Expect poor prices for transactions that are under $10,000. Yeah, they don't even want to go away, right? Unless you are big, meaning you have a lot of money, don't expect to be treated well. Remember John Merriweather, how he treated his boss? He'll treat you a whole lot worse. Investors use banks often or other entities to trade bonds as well as brokers. And there's a newspaper that I don't even know if it's still published in paper form. It might just be online now. The Bond Buyer, which lists, you know, people wanting to sell and buy bonds. Now, there's a major exception to this that we've already looked at back in Chapter 1. Remember TreasuryDirect.gov? Exactly. The small investor, I got my $1,000, I want to buy a bond. The small investor is treated well at TreasuryDirect.gov. You get the same price as the people who are buying millions of dollars or billions of dollars. Cool? Okay. Slide number 40, bond quotes. Bonds are usually quoted as a percentage of par. So if you see 97.25, that means 97.25% of the par value. But, folks, par is almost always $1,000. So to make this easy, all you do is move the decimal place two to the left. So 97.25 times 1,000 is $972.50. You just move the decimal place one to the right. I'm sorry, did I say the left? I said the left. One to the right. Simply move the decimal place one to the right. So if you see 97.25, you know it's worth $972.50. Now, if it's a $10,000 bond or a $5,000 bond, we don't have to worry about that. Just think of it in terms of $1,000 bonds, because most are. 97.25 is a bond quote for a bond selling at a discount. Excellent. A bond selling at a premium would be quoted above 100. A bond selling at par would be quoted at 100. Right, it's selling at par, 100%. Now, you can use finance.yahoo.com/bonds, but it's been working really weird, and I don't trust it anymore. I really don't trust it, and you're going to take a look at they're not up there yet, but the presentation for these bond quotes will be up there soon. You'll see that there's something wrong. I've sent emails to Value Bond, which is the company that Yahoo uses, and I've tried to send stuff to Yahoo, but it won't do it. It keeps saying, thank you, please enter all the, tell us about the problem, and then as soon as you hit submit, it goes, bing, it says, sorry, I can't do this, so maybe Yahoo doesn't really want to know. So I've been using FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, for bond quotes, and of course there's a link on the website that you can use. You don't have to drill down from FINRA. FINRA is the organization, non-governmental but not-for-profit, that regulates the industry, regulates the brokerage firms, the brokers, and you can look up your potential broker or your current broker on FINRA.org. And they have a bond quote system that seems a whole lot better than Yahoo's. So for Chapter 9's assignment, I suggest you use FINRA. It's a lot, much more reliable. Okay, so that is our introduction to bonds, governments, corporates, mortgage-backed securities, muni bonds, and interest rates. As I said before, if you find yourself falling asleep, it's great for insomnia. Yeah, the book when it comes to bonds are real exciting. They're great. If you can't get to sleep at night, crack open the book on bonds and go to sleep. Make sure you understand what's in the presentation. All right? And then check out the other links on the Chapter 9 section of the website. When we come back, we're going to start bond pricing, bond valuation, and bond yield. So we'll learn how to calculate the yield of a bond and find a couple of, well, mostly one, way to value bonds. And hint, 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 it will look very similar to something we've already done. See you next time.